couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Ordinary Angels and Driveaway Dolls, and also talk about True Detective Night Country, The Black Hole, and The Black Cauldron. I'm also going to be talking about some news, The Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup, featuring a look back at Darkman. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Mastodon or Blue Sky, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look at the box office for last week. It was a disaster for Madame Web. And what's so funny is a lot of people report this as saying it's the lowest Marvel movie. You got to understand, this is not Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is Sony going rogue, trying to build their own Spider-Man franchise outside of Spider-Man. And it's not working. I mean, yeah, Venom has a certain appeal, but, you know, Morbius was terrible. Madame Web is a mess. And I'm sure Kraven the Hunter's not going to be much better. Maybe that's going to be a masterpiece. Who knows? But Madame Web cratered this weekend. There's a bunch of different numbers you can use as saying what its opening weekend. Let's just talk about it from it opening on Wednesday, on Valentine's Day, through President's Day. That's 6 days with time off and not a huge conflict of events. It only made $26 million over that 6 days. What came in number one was the Bob Marley biopic, Bob Marley One Love. That made over $51 million in that 6 day weekend. If you just look at it as President's Day weekend, Bob Marley One Love made almost $34 million, and Madame Web only made just a hair below $18 million. That is terrible for Madame Web, and very good for Bob Marley One Love. Now, I don't think anyone was expecting that one to do as well. That was one of those surprise things. But I've always said, you know, you put something right that's out there for an underserved audience, you're going to get people going to see the movie. And then like 3, 4, 5, you had Argyle, Migration, Wonka, The Chosen episodes 4 through 6 over the 6 day made about $5 million. And then it just kind of goes down from there. And what's funny is to see all these hot takes on and these people trying to explain what happened. Is it because women were the superheroes? No. Madame Web didn't do well because it was a terrible movie and it was an unknown character. It's kind of the same thing with the Marvels. I talked about this last week. The Marvels didn't click because none of those characters are well-known characters. And this character of Madame Web, while people who read Spider-Man comics know who she is, nobody outside of that does. There's this ability for executives in Hollywood to think, people just love superheroes. No, they like superheroes with known characters and ones they can get behind. Madame Web was a mess. And it was a mess at its core. And the Marvels didn't do well, not because there were women in it. It's just you didn't build an audience into those. There's so much that can be said for characters that people can know and relate to. And I don't think anybody could relate to any of the characters in Madame Web. That was disastrous. I think people are just holding on and saying, oh, let's see what happens when Dune 2 comes out, because that's going to be your first big, huge weekend of the year. The next piece of news I want to hit really quickly is the Fantastic Forecast. I didn't get to talk about this earlier. Pedro Pascal as Mr. Fantastic, which is actually a great win for them because he's the it guy. Now, again, his presence in a movie isn't going to make it a huge hit. If you recall, he played the bad guy in Wonder Woman 1984, and nobody called that the greatest movie ever because he was in it. So you got to have a good script to it. Now, Vanessa Kirby, I think she's kind of a flavor of the month kind of thing. I mean, she's good, and she's attractive, and she can act. I mean, she's fine, but I always liked Jessica Alba in it. I actually like those original Fantastic Four movies that Fox did in the early part of the 2000s or middle of the 2000s. I know they're much maligned, but I always enjoyed them because, you know, at least for what that era of superhero filmmaking was. I always said bringing in the Fantastic Four and the X-Men, that's what's going to save the Marvel Universe, because Marvel needs that fresh blood. And then finally, just a little note, Disney is going to be leaning back into physical media, which I think is great. I'm a huge fan of physical media because then you have it. If you have the physical media, no one's going to come and take your DVD away from you. But there have been multiple situations where rights issues have caused a conflict, so something you've bought that you can stream on a service suddenly becomes unavailable. So if I really, really want something, I'll buy a disc. But if it's just something I'm like I'll watch a thing and I'll be like, oh, I'll watch it again. I'll sometimes just buy it on streaming. But it's always good to have that disc. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is coming to Disney Plus. It's a limited series, and I think it drops next week sometime. I think February 28th. It's, and I think I'm pronouncing this right, Iwaju.
What would you say if I asked you to go to the mainland?
You want to see the real Lagos?
Yes, let's go.
Welcome to Lagos, Nigeria.
Tolap, your daddy has done well for himself.
Otin,
where's my daughter? She's your responsibility.
Some of these people are actually dangerous.
I laugh in the face of danger.
I didn't hear you laugh. Oh.
This is a project that Disney collaborated with an African-based, I think it's a gaming company originally, and they're very, very popular in Africa. And they decided to kind of, because here's the thing. A lot of people go, oh, this is so woke filmmaking. No, what they're trying to do is they're trying to cross-pollinate. Disney Plus, its business is not just an American business. It's going worldwide. And that can be noted because there was a big dip in its streaming numbers last year. Had nothing to do with American taste. It had to do with the fact that I think there was something how they changed their cricket coverage in India, and it affected their subscriber rates. So you got to remember, when it comes to streaming, when it comes to internet distribution, when it comes to just entertainment, it's not just an American thing. There, you have to think globally if you're a big company like Disney. And so this is them trying to bridge the gap. And sure, maybe nobody will watch it in America, but they'll definitely watch it in the African countries. And it looks kind of, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure what's going on. It looks like this girl's being targeted, and she has this little, I guess, like a lizard that helps protect her. But it looks interesting. Takes place in this sort of this futuristic Nigeria. I'm curious about that. I don't know much about it, but I'll check it out when it drops. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Borderlands, which is coming to theaters on August 9th.
Legend has it that there's this massive treasure hidden in some secret vault. And if you go hunting for it, you'd better take any help you can get. Because it's on the weirdest, most dangerous dumpster fire of a world in the universe.
God, I hate this planet.
This is directed by Eli Roth, which, I don't know, this is kind of a big project for him. He usually doesn't do stuff this big. It kind of looks like a Zack Snyder piece to me. But the reason it's not is because there's not as much slow-mo, and it actually has a color palette to it. That's one of the things I'm appreciating about this trailer, is at least it looks like it's going to be something interesting to watch. I don't know anything about the original game, but this trailer makes it feel like it's this cross between the Suicide Squad and Guardians of the Galaxy, with the kind of the ragtag group of people and the pop music sound to it. I'll check it out. I'm curious. It's got some good people involved, but then again, you know, Eli Roth has had his ups and downs. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going dark and going to be talking about the black hole and the black cauldron. Welcome Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into some vintage releases that I was poking around on Disney Plus for. And there's a reason I kind of swerve into these things. I've been trying to cover some classic titles as well, not just the brand new ones, partly because there's not always a lot of new ones to cover. But I like going back and looking at some stuff. And in particular, part of the reason I picked The Black Hole, because last week I talked about The Watcher in the Woods. And The Watcher in the Woods was made at a time when Disney was known very much as a kid's thing. They did animated films and Swiss Family Robinson type movies. And they were trying to diversify and get a bigger audience and get the kids that are no longer little kids. And so they started making movies in the late 70s and early 80s that could be arguably young adult oriented, where they're a little bit darker, where they got a little bit heavier themes to them. And The Black Hole is one of those movies. It was one of the earlier ones in that run, but it's definitely worth talking about. An exploratory spaceship encounters a madman surrounded by robots on a ghost ship orbiting a black hole.
There is an inexorable force in the cosmos where time and space converge.
And my ship, you ask.
Fire thrusters. That madman is headed straight for the black hole. What'll we do?
We wait.
No.
Gravity's at maximum, Dan.
My God, I think it's got us.
Man is about to enter.
We gotta wait here, too.
The black hole.
This was made in 1979. It came out on the tail of Star Wars. You know, Star Wars had just come out 2 years before, and it was a huge thing, and everybody wanted their own Star Wars. But the thing is, you got to remember, Star Wars was unique. Star Wars was like the only one of its kind out there at the time. And so people were trying to throw things at the wall and see what sticks. And what's interesting about The Black Hole is it has this epic feel. It doesn't really feel like a Star Wars type story until you get into kind of the character interaction. But the scope of the movie feels like the stuff that was made, you know, like Forbidden Planet or something like even 2001. Or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. There's a lot of connective tissue between 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Black Hole, with sort of the madman running a ship that has special abilities. And I remember when it came out, it was rated PG. So it was not a G-rated movie, because it had some pretty dark stuff in there. How Anthony Perkins' character dies has stuck with me. I remember seeing it when I was 8? And how he gets killed in that movie, you're just like, oh my God. It's shocking, and it still sticks with me to this day. But it also had this amazing production design, had these robots. One of them was Maximilian, which was this red robot, always looked fantastic. And then they had these little floaty robots. One of them was called Vincent, and it's voiced by Roddy McDowall. It's a very cute thing. I have always had an affinity for The Black Hole. I didn't love it as a kid because it's a deeper and darker movie than you expect it to be. But at the same time, it gets this Disney push to it where it gives kind of these gee whiz characters, and they're not terribly well developed, but they fit in these archetypes that work. You got like Robert Forster as the captain, Vetmin Mew from The Time Machine, and the madman is played by Maximilian Schell, who just chews all the scenery in the most beautiful way. He is a Bond villain that stumbles into this movie. And that's really what it is. It's this weird mix of these elements where you've got this grand scale of trying to do this space odyssey, which links to 2001. And then you have sort of like the Western side of the shoot 'em up with the robots and everything. Even to the point you got Slim Pickens doing the voice of one of the robots, and he's got this twang to his voice. And then at the same time, you are also playing around with some really existential stuff and tying it into some other classics. It's a weirdly paced movie. It's 90 minutes, but it doesn't quite charge forward. But it also, it's a beautiful looking movie. It's available on Disney Plus. Check it out. But this is a bizarre Disney-fied mashup of Forbidden Planet and Star Wars. And its darker existential story is imperfect, but it's also fascinating because it goes into these really dark, weird areas without making it kid-friendly. So I this is one of those movies that is in the Disney vaults that I think is one that would never get made today the way it is because of the way the studio structure works. But I'm very glad it happened, and I'm glad that it's accessible. I'm going to say that The Black Hole totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Well, if I was talking about PG-rated movies that Disney made in the 70s and 80s with black in the title, you can't ignore The Black Cauldron. This animated Disney adventure follows an assistant pig keeper who tries to stop an evil horned king from tapping into the power of the legendary Black Cauldron.
The horned king, that black-hearted devil.
Escape into a world of darkness.
Are you coming?
Me? Go in there? Oh, no, no, no. It's a terrible place.
A world of excitement. A world of dreams.
Aaron, the greatest warrior, a true hero.
What's so funny about this movie? It's notable because it was the first animated Disney film to get a PG rating because of some scary imagery, which arguably I don't think it's any scarier than some of the stuff you see in Fantasia or Sleeping Beauty. It's just they were realizing that this has a darker angle to it. But it also has these very Disney elements to it. It has this scene with these fairies that really they feel like they're plucked out of a bad Disney cartoon. And what's funny is my personal experience getting to this is I think it was Lloyd Alexander wrote the book. He wrote a series. There's like five or six in the series. And I remember as a kid, I might have been like middle school. It might have been like sixth grade. The librarian at the school, they would still do like a read aloud thing. And she read The Black Cauldron to us. And we loved it. The book was gripping and fun. And then the movie came out in 1985. And I remember going to see it and being sorely disappointed. It's not a very good adaptation of the book. And it's been years since I've seen it. So I rewatched it this week because I was just curious. And like I said, sort of the connective tissue is both The Black Hole and The Black Cauldron were rarities because at the time Disney was not making PG content or PG-13 content. But this one, it has some haphazard storytelling. There's one character, and you hear him in the trailer there, he's sort of their sidekick, and they kind of go too cute with him. The character is kind of more of this like little goblin thing, but they make him like this fuzzy puppy. They have the dark imagery, but Disney-fied it too much. It would be like if Disney in the early 80s did a version of Lord of the Rings. It would not have been as faithful to the story. And that's a shame because they did like 70 millimeter capture on this one, and they did some actually early computer generated work, and they spent a ton of money and it flopped because the story's not there. And it goes back to what I was saying about Madam Web. You need to have a good story. Do not discount your writers. But yeah, this takes some big swings for the first PG rated Disney animated film, but the unfocused plot makes this adventure difficult to follow. It's even though I knew the story, and that's, I think, one of the things that was frustrating when I was a kid and I saw this. Well, the story was such a good story and they fumble it. It doesn't hold up. I was not impressed. I'm going to have to say that The Black Cauldron kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Ordinary Angels and Drive Away Dolls. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. We're going to be talking about the new ones this week. The first one, Ordinary Angel. A woman looking to change her life takes up the cause to help a family of a girl that needs a liver transplant.
Something about that little girl without a mama, sick, and the family bled dry from all the hospital bills. I think I'm supposed to help.
Hi, Sharon.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to come by and give you this.
I just made dinner if you want to stay.
Would love to.
Mom, what are you doing? I met this woman. She's a mess.
Perfect. She'll fit right in.
$400,000 plus in medical bills.
Yes, ma'am.
That's not good, Ed.
No, ma'am.
I guess it's technically a faith-based movie. and I usually talk about this whenever I talk about a faith-based movie, is I just don't think the filmmaking is as good as it could be. And so when I see a faith-based movie that actually has good writing and acting and development, I like to call it out. I remember the movie Risen. That was the one with Joseph Fiennes, who was the Roman centurion, who was tasked with finding the body of Jesus. There was another one called Heaven Is For Real, and even though it had some wonky casting choices in that, it's clear the people in the church got involved and put non-actors in a couple roles. But that was the one with Greg Kinnear about the Burpos, whose kid, who's having like near-death experiences. That was a well-made movie. The one where Jennifer Garner's daughter's caught in a tree. That one's a pretty well-made movie. And Ordinary Angels, it's got some good people behind it. And in terms of good artists, it's not just thrown together faith-based filmmaking. Sometimes the people that are working on it, they're passionate, but they're not always the best at what they do. But this one has some really good elements behind it. Starting from the script stage, what blew my mind is I saw Meg Tilly's name show up as a writer. And I know she's done some writing, but I was like, oh, I didn't expect to see her in this one. But more importantly, Kelly Freeman Craig worked with her on the script. And Kelly Freeman Craig is a great filmmaker, and she really connects with an audience. She did, and she directed, The Edge of 17 and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which seems like an odd choice to suddenly then take her and make her do a faith-based movie. But I think they're not worried about, and I think this is the core of why this movie works so well, is it was less worried about the faith element and more worried about telling a good story. And it seems counterintuitive to say, let's leave the religious stuff to the side because that's kind of why we're making the movie. But that can be very jarring. If you put a regular audience in front of a film and they feel like they're being preached at, they will not respond well. And so that's sort of something for people who have an evangelical bent to them. As soon as you become aggressive with the evangelical side, you will turn people off. The best way to do it is to lead by example, and then when you're asked, bring it up, because if you're too pushy, you're going to lose people. And that's, I think, what makes this movie work. On top of it, you've got some really good cast. Hilary Swank does a great job. She carries the movie, and she carries the emotional burden. And her character is flawed, but she manages to do it without being too cheesy. And boy, somebody else in this role could have really flopped in it, but she really nails it. And then you got Alan Ritchson, who's from Reacher, who doesn't get a lot of dramatic work because everybody just sees him as a big heavy, you know, in Reacher, he does some in that, but you know, he was in the Fast and Furious movie. He's just a big dude. And so he gets a chance to shine. He can act in it. And you've got Nancy Travis as his mother, and she does a good job in it. So you got a lot of good people involved with this movie. And it tells a very uplifting story. And the other reason why, and I'm reticent to keep coming back to this, but one of the things about this movie is, yes, it can have a religious message. But, if, you know, the whole things are trying to get this girl a liver transplant. And it's in Kentucky, and it's during a snowstorm. And the snow is just getting worse and worse and worse. It's very hard to make that thing of saying, look how much God is helping get this girl. It's literally an act of God was what was standing in the way. You know, I know God works in mysterious ways and everything, but you know, they back off from that message because it's less about the miracle that God sort of ordains. And it's more normal everyday people standing up and doing what they can. Now, the other thing this movie does is it makes that case of there's something seriously wrong with our healthcare system, if it's bankrupting families and putting parents in a situation where they have to make impossible decisions. They need to get their kid to the hospital and get her treated, but they have no money. And, you know, and not because they're lazy, but because they have $400,000 in medical debt already. And I mean, this is a discussion to have for another day. And granted, the movie does take place in the 90s. So I don't know how the difference is, but I know there's still a lot of people who face crippling debt from medical expenses. And I think that that's brought up inadvertently in this movie that they don't address. But, you know, overall, it does kind of focus on that uplifting story. And that's what makes it work. I mean, it is an uplifting film that rises from the corniness because of a strong cast and a balanced script. That's what makes this movie work. I was surprised. I reluctantly watched this movie because it's not my cup of tea. But as I'm watching, I'm like, you know what? Doggone it. If they didn't make a good movie, that's worth seeing. I'm going to say that Ordinary Angels kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Driveaway Dolls. In 1999, two lesbians take a road trip from Philadelphia to Tallahassee with a mysterious suitcase some dangerous people are looking for.
I've had it with love. I don't believe it's relevant to the 21st century lesbian.
I'm leaving town.
I am too. That was my plan. Where are you going?
Tallahassee, Florida. I've been unhappy.
That's why we take this trip together, honey babe.
We get our act together, together.
We're here for the car.
Wait a minute. You call with a drop-off in Tallahassee, and then these broads come in and say they're ready to go to Tallahassee. They drive the car instead of you. Is that bad?
Bad if they find the goods.
This is most notable because it's directed and co-written by Ethan Coen. And if you don't know that name, he's one of the Coen brothers. And the Coen brothers, you know, all the way to the 80s with stuff like Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, and then, you know, other films into the 90s like the Fargo and The Big Lebowski. I mean, they're fantastic filmmakers. And recently, it's not that they had some big schism. It's just I had read somewhere they said it just felt too much like work. And so they decided to kind of do their own thing. And so this is sort of like a member of a band who does his or her own solo album, but isn't like estranged from the band. And that's a good analogy because that doesn't always work. You know, even masterful figures like Freddie Mercury, his solo stuff never quite clicked the way the Queen stuff did. And that's one of the things I feel like with Driveaway Dolls. It just doesn't have that same freshness. It feels forced in a lot of ways. And the Coen Brothers stuff has always been kind of quirky and weird and fun and sometimes understated, sometimes over the top. And it seems like he's almost trying to emulate that, but he needed this countering effect from his brother that he's not getting with this. At times it goes very, very over the top and it plays in that extreme, but it just doesn't work in that extreme. It seems overdone. It seems like it's trying too hard. And like the cast, the stars Geraldine Viswanathan and Margaret Qualley. And Geraldine Viswanathan she's fine in it. She's a little understated. She's a great example of the character that's too subdued. And then Margaret Qualley is over the top, like in an annoying way. She does this Texas accent that's just, she's bad in this movie. Margaret Qualley is bad in this movie. They don't have any real chemistry there. There's a lot of problems with this film, and I was disappointed because I love the Coen Brothers stuff, and I think Ethan Coen didn't quite make a great movie. I mean, it's a disappointing solo debut for Ethan Coen, and it delivers a film that goes too far and not far enough at the same time. So I'm going to have to say Driveaway Dolls kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about True Detective Night Country and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Darkman. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews, and I want to talk about one that just ended on HBO, and that is True Detective Night Country. In a small Alaskan town during an extended darkness, a group of dead bodies are found frozen in the ice.
I'm working on this new case. A missing scientist.
Found on the edge of the villages.
Frozen solid.
What do you want?
It's been 6 years. Why are you here?
Because we both know what really happened. And you need my help.
I've seen that before. Years ago.
Fine.
I'm just going to do this one thing. Work together to close this case. That's it for the two of us.
All right. I never watched the original True Detective back when it became a thing. What, like, it was like 10 years ago or something. I finally got around to watching it, like, around Christmas. And, I mean, it's good. The first season of True Detective is good. And, you know, it stars Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And I thought it was an interesting look at darkness and human behavior and the evil that men do. I never watched the other two seasons because Night Country then kicked off and I started watching that. And what blew my mind is most of the stories that I was seeing about it were not actually about the show. It was about this weird backlash, this weird sort of incel backlash that you get online. Because here's the thing. The best way to get noticed on the internet is to be extreme and insulting. Nobody wants a balanced opinion on the internet. Nobody wants a mitigating force in the internet. They go for the extremes. The videos on YouTube you get, the more obnoxious and mean-spirited and outraged you are, the more the views are. And then with some of the changes, for example, on Twitter, which I refuse to call the other thing, because of the changes that the current guy who runs that site has done, just promotes this. It promotes mean-spirited interactions. That's the problem with the internet, is everyone has to have this opinion, and things have to be the worst, and they have to go after them. And so then you have these things like Madam Web. I was looking up something on Madam Web, and there are these videos, and it's like, Madam Web, I couldn't even make it through the movie. I'm like, quit being such a baby. First of all, Madam Web is not the worst movie ever. I've seen a lot worse this year. That's the problem. And so there's a bunch of people that went bonkers about True Detective Night Country because, I guess, because it was about women. Why is that a problem? Why is that offensive? It's a show that has women. Why is that suddenly so out there as an idea to do? I mean, you've got like Jodie Foster. She's an Academy Award winning actor. She is great in this. Because there is that toxic masculinity out there that just wants to grind us into the dirt because it gets clicks. So don't give them oxygen. Because here's the thing. True Detective Night Country just finished and had one of the best ratings ever. Best ratings for the series. So, you know, obviously it's not terrible. And here's the thing. I'm watching the movie and I'm like, I really like what they're doing here. In fact, arguably, I like it a little bit more than the first season because I thought it was a little bit more interesting and I think they had more vulnerable characters. One of the things the first season does is it plays around with what makes you a good person, because the characters that McConaughey and Harrelson play are both bad people. They're objectively, in a lot of ways, bad people. And the stuff they do is bad and wrong. But they're kind of like helping a greater good by taking down this murderer. And the same thing with True Detective Night Country. Jodie Foster's character is no better or worse than Woody Harrelson's character in the first season. She is just as damaged, just as problematic, just as mean-spirited. And that's kind of what I think is so fascinating about it, because they don't really change up the characters. They're all flawed, heavily flawed individuals trying to do the right thing. And the other thing that Night Country does is it ties it up with, it connects to the other seasons. And then it also has these great visual references to stuff like The Thing, which is a brilliant movie made in the desolate wastes, mostly at night. So, yeah, I mean, strong performances drive this season home, and they have some clever connections to the other seasons and enough supernatural hints to help it rise above a typical procedure. I really enjoyed this season of True Detective, and I'm thrilled that they've renewed it. It's so vastly different than the first season. I'll probably go back and watch seasons 2 and 3 at some point, but it was nice to bookend these things with two good and two very different series that also share a lot of connective tissue. I'm going to say True Detective Night Country totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening 2, Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on the 4K release of Darkman. Shout Factory has delivered another great 4K release, another classic movie from the vaults. In Darkman, Sam Raimi directs this original comic book style movie about a disfigured scientist whose research into artificial flesh allows him to masquerade as anyone he wants.
Crime has a new enemy, and justice has a brand new face.
I was afraid that you wouldn't want me anymore.
Of course I still want you.
The good news is that I know who's behind our little troubles of late. Finish it.
He has the power to look like any man.
I gotta tell you something about me.
He's a cockroach. You think you're killing? And he pops up someplace else.
As the story goes, Sam Raimi wanted to direct Batman, but the job went to Tim Burton. And so he's like, fine, I'll just do my own version of Batman. And so he created this Darkman character. Darkman does not come from the comic books. It's just inspired by comic books. But weirdly, it's one of the best comic book movies of its era, even though it wasn't an original story. With inspiring cinematography and a fun pulpy plot. I mean, it has all the stuff that really kind of makes it rise to the top of the late 80s, early 90s Batman era movies. When you watch this, there are scenes, there are shots that look like they're pulled directly from the comics. And they're assembled and they're designed not in a cheesy sort of way, the way that like Ang Lee, when he did The Hulk, he had the frames and the panels in there. No, Sam Raimi wasn't that on the nose with it. He just shot a lot of the scenes framed like a comic book. And if you actually go back and you read something like The Dark Knight Returns, which is a classic Frank Miller graphic novel from the late 80s, looks like he used that as a template for his design and aesthetic. And this movie also shows a relatively young Liam Neeson. I mean, he'd done stuff, especially in Ireland, and you know he had done some other stuff in the States. But this was really the first time he kind of came on the map for me. This was, you know, almost 10 years before he did Star Wars, and he had Frances McDormand as the love interest, which I mean, she when she was younger she could pull it off, but really she still even then she was sort of playing, you know, a different character. So it was just that the Raimis knew her, you know, Ted Raimi and Sam Raimi. And the best part about it, one of the best parts actually, is Larry Drake as the bad guy. Now, if you don't remember back at the time, I think he was on L.A. Law, which was a TV series, and he played this very gentle, mentally retarded character. And he was just very sweet. And so he took this character that's 180 degrees out of phase with that, and was this dastardly criminal bad guy, this thug that worked with this, a building developer in a big city. And so this marks all of those boxes that you'd need for a crazy, over-the-top, action-filled, science fiction, superhero-type movie. So, yeah, I mean, and then the 4K, I mean, it looks beautiful too. I mean, they got a new transfer supervised by Raimi. They got a whole bunch of new special features. They've got an audio commentary. They got deleted scenes, and they got all these old vintage behind the scenes videos with the actors and the people involved. It's loaded with special features. The 4K is what makes it really brilliant, because you get to see a pristine, brilliant look at it. Cause the Blu-ray that's out there, or at least the Blu-ray I already have, it doesn't have as good of a transfer as what you get with this 4K. Shout Factory has delivered something really good here, and they always do a great job sort of trying to preserve the genre fiction from the decades, and right now they're kind of working through the 90s. So I really enjoyed Darkman, which they also have like a steel book with a bunch of posters and stuff like that. But yeah, the 4K of Darkman totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Dune Part 2. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.